This is Barbara Ridenour, and returning with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald in Review, dated November 20th, 2015. We will continue with the obituaries. Orithea Ann Raglan, 73 of Decatur, died Friday, November 13th, 2015. Funeral services will be held at noon Saturday, November 21st, at Walker Funeral Service and Chapel. Visitation is 1 hour before service. Burial in Greenwood Cemetery. Walker Funeral Service and Chapel is in charge of arrangements. Evelyn Marie Shute, 97 of Decatur, died Monday, November 16, 2015. Services to celebrate her life will be held at 6 p.m. Monday, November 23rd, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the services at the funeral home. Burial will be at 1 p.m. Tuesday, November 24th, at Zion Grove Cemetery in Dix, Illinois. Memorials may be directed to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Charles E. Chuck Morris, 73 of Monticello, died on Wednesday, November 18, 2015. Services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, November 21st, at the Monticello United Methodist Church. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. today, November 20th, at the Mackey Wright Funeral Home with Masonic rites at 6 p.m. Interment will be in Monticello Township Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the Monticello United Methodist Church Building Fund in Monticello. Ernest Lee Beasley, 60 of Decatur, died Thursday, November 12, 2015. Celebration of life will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, November 21st, at Greater Mount Olive Missionary Baptist Church. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday in the church. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Now we'll turn to the opinion page and continue with letters to the editor. The best ideas from the presidential candidates. I've been watching the presidential campaign debates with great interest. Like many other people, I've decided that no single candidate has all the answers. Some of them have a good idea or two, so let's consolidate them into one plan. Here are my selections offered by all of the candidates in no particular order. None of them are my original ideas. Revise the tax code, eliminate the business killing regulations, and abolish the IRS. As one of the candidates said, any of the tax plans suggested would be better than what we have now. Institute term limits on Congress, a job that was never intended to be a career. We should also outlaw campaign contributions from lobbyists and special interest groups. Foreign governments should not be permitted to lobby Congress. A lifetime ban on former congressmen becoming lobbyists would also be helpful. Cutting government spending is another great goal, and downsizing the government by eliminating 4 or 5 bloated agencies sounds like a sensible way to pay for the military and other things we need. Let's add Obamacare to the list. The VA is serving our veterans miserably. Let them obtain health care on the local market and have the VA specialize in handling what they do well, like prosthetics and PTSD. Immigration without assimilation is invasion. Those who come here should want to become Americans, not establish an enclave of the old country they came from. Learn the language, educate children, earn a living, and build a better life. How many other countries could we infiltrate the way they are coming here? We need an immigration policy that includes a way to deal humanely with families and the deportation of immigrant criminals, whether they are legal or not. Signed, Gordon R. Shishun, Decatur. Thumbs up, thumbs down. thumbs up to the beginning of high school basketball and for what could be a memorable season for a lot of local teams. While prep football winds down, we're looking forward to cold nights spent in hot, noisy gyms. There are several teams, both boys and girls, which could have a noteworthy winter and early spring. Good luck to all the teams and their fans, and remember that sportsmanship will be remembered long after the results of the games are forgotten. Thumbs up to Ameren, Illinois, for the announcement of its new gas control center to be built at 2425 North Woodford Street in Decatur. The 12,100-foot square foot, $5.3 million facility will employ about 20 people when it is completed and will improve the company remote monitoring of gas lines. The facility also further cements the relationship between Ameren and the Decatur community. Thumbs up to the village of Mount Zion, which is getting ready to open the refurbished Sulphur Springs Schoolhouse as a museum. The one-room school, since being moved to the village's Fletcher Park, has been refurbished to reflect its original use and has been filled with items donated by area residents. The museum is still a work in progress, but was opened this week for an open house and will open on a regular basis later this fall. Thumbs up to the Humane Society of Decatur in Macon County, which will move into a new permanent home in a few days. The new home is located at 3373 North Woodford Street in the former Nexus Vision, Illinois building. The new, more spacious home isn't complete yet, but it's finished enough for the dogs and cats to move in as the rest of the building is completed. The new building will not only give the Humane Society a new home, but will also give the dogs and cats more room. Many local businesses have donated money and services to make the new home possible. The society needs about $35,000 more dollars to complete the work. Thumbs down to the protesters at University of Missouri, including a communications professor that tried to keep journalists away from public protests on public property. Apparently, the protesters didn't understand that the First Amendment that gave them the right to demonstrate gave journalists the right to report on their activities, a fact that a communications professor at the university was at the forefront of trying to keep journalists away from the protests is troubling. Maybe the university needs to give its students and faculty a refresher course on the U.S. Constitution. National editorial Steve Chapman, Tribune News Service writer. Steve Chapman, GOP candidate's reaction to attacks show lack of knowledge. Adversity, it's been said, doesn't build character, it reveals it. The terrorist attacks in Paris managed to expose a lot about the character and wisdom of several Republican candidates for president, and the discoveries are not reassuring. The entire field is united in condemning Barack Obama's handling of the war against the Islamic State, also known as ISIS. The candidates' ideas on how to do it better, however, fall into three categories: redundant, meaningless, and reckless. Carly Fiorina is at a disadvantage critiquing the administration because she has no apparent idea what the administration is doing. The first step, she declared, is acknowledging that ISIS is at war with us, and therefore we must be at war with them. She is probably the last person to realize that we are already at war with the Islamic State. Over the past 15 months, the U.S. military has carried out more than 6,300 airstrikes, which it says have killed upwards of 10,000 enemy fighters. Fiorina also insists she would provide arms to the Kurdish forces fighting the Islamic State, as well as the government of Jordan, but the U.S. already supplies weapons to the Kurds, though it routes them through the Baghdad government. The administration announced in September that it would increase military aid to Jordan and provide weapons more advanced than in the past. As for Egypt, a National Security Council spokesperson told me the U.S. has provided intelligence analysis on the October airline bombing, among other matters. Donald Trump said he would bomb the bleep out of them, with a focus on the enemy's oil infrastructure. He missed the story in the New York Times the day before the Paris attacks that reported, "The United States and his allies have sharply increased their airstrikes against the sprawling oil fields that the Islamic State controls in eastern Syria in an effort to disrupt one of the terrorist group's main sources of revenue," American officials said this week. Ted Cruz has the notion that you win wars with words. He says we are handicapped by a commander-in-chief unwilling even to utter the words radical Islamic terrorism. To Islamic State fighters who worry about being vaporized by hellfire missiles, Obama's preference for terms like violent extremists is cold comfort. The president, like Hillary Clinton, avoids Cruz's favored nomenclature in deference to our Muslim allies. You certainly do not want to describe the threat in terms of a war on Islam, Juan Carlos Zarate, an advisor to President George W. Bush on terrorism, has said. We struggled mightily about how you describe the ideology. Cruz believes that to stop an enemy that slaughters innocent people, we have to slaughter innocent people. The Islamic State, he said, will not be deterred by targeted airstrikes with zero tolerance for civilian casualties. Excuse me. It will cheer him up to learn. It will cheer him up to learn that Canada's CBC News found credible allegations that up to 600 civilians have died in the U.S. air campaign. It doesn't occur to Cruz that each innocent person blown up by an American bomb produces more people eager to slaughter Americans. Trump, Ben Carson, Jeb Bush, and John Kasich have indicated a willingness to use ground troops, but none proposes the sort of numbers deployed in Afghanistan, which peaked at around 100,000, and in Iraq, 166,000. The candidates don't acknowledge that a small force might be inadequate. Then what? Go big or go home? Marco Rubio took a novel attack, criticizing Cruz and Rand Paul for supporting the USA Freedom Act, which curbed the National Security Agency's collection of Americans' phone records. He charged that this weakening of our intelligence-gathering capabilities leaves America vulnerable. But a federal court and a presidential review commission found no evidence that the program prevented a single attack. Rubio may not realize that we are far likelier to get information on the Islamic State from a separate NSA program, which involves listening to the phone calls and reading the emails of foreigners abroad suspected of terrorist activities, a program the USA Freedom Act left alone. For sheer vacuity, it's hard to top Carson, who said, "I would be working with our allies using every resource known to man in terms of economic resources, in terms of covert resources, overt resources, military resources, things that they don't know about resources." Maybe Obama is already deploying all the resources they don't know about. That's information Carson wouldn't have. But in this group, lack of knowledge is no hindrance. In entertainment, Underground Theater delivers with musical. Decatur Underground Theater may have a name that sounds secretive, but they create performances everyone will soon know, especially during this season's version of Irving Berlin's White Christmas. The local theater production company opened the post-World War II classic musical last weekend and will continue this weekend with three performances at 7 p.m. today and Saturday, November 21st, and 2 p.m. Sunday, November 22nd, at the Decatur Civic Center. Decatur Underground Theater formed 5 years ago with the hope of bringing theater lovers to the stage, or at least into the seats. They highlight local talent in popular Broadway musical productions, such as Jesus Christ Superstar and West Side Story. The Decatur Underground Theater's rendition of White Christmas has the musical style Irving Berlin would love to hear. The story follows two ex-WW2 soldiers 10 years later after becoming celebrities. They meet up with two singing siblings, the Haynes sisters. Of course, love ensues, but not until after some conflicts and beautiful love songs, such as The Best Things Happen While You're Dancing and Count Your Blessings. The movie's iconic song, White Christmas, appears early in the production, the second number, with Brad Barting's elegant rendition as lead character Bob Wallace. Everything Barting sang demanded attention, whether as a solo, part of an ensemble, or as a duet with singing partner Phil Davis, played by Dylan Bethard. The entire cast works well together. The voices and harmonies are high energy, tight, and dead on. Early in Act Two, the audience almost came to their feet during Saturday's performance of Falling Out of Love Can Be Fun, a song performed by Martha Watson, Gina Tomlinson, and the Haynes sisters, Emily Steele and Tara Russell. Martha became one of the favorite characters as the show progressed. Sadly, she doesn't appear until over halfway into Act One. There is no doubt the cast can sing and act, but in a Broadway show, they can also dance, and a feat the cast too often missed. The sets were simple but appropriate for a 1954 setting, except for the modern, colorful mesh Christmas wreath hanging in a rustic Vermont inn. Although Saturday's performance had a few microphone delays, the actors knew how to compensate by speaking louder or drawing closer to a fellow actor's mic. The Decatur Underground Theater renews the holiday spirit during White Christmas with beautiful songs and singers. They have a reputation of hiring great singers, and this show was no exception. If you go, it's the Decatur Underground Theater's production of White Christmas. It's today at 7 p.m. and Saturday, November 21st at 2 p.m. and Sunday, November 22nd. Oh. Today and Saturday at 7 p.m., 2 p.m. Sunday, at the Decatur Civic Center. General admission is $15, front row $20. Dear Dr. Roach, can newspapers be an allergen? Dear Dr. Roach, have you ever heard of anyone being allergic or sensitive to newspaper print? I read the newspaper from front to I read the newspaper from front to back and like to know what the latest news is. I always seem to have burning eyes, itchy nose, and some difficulty breathing. Is an allergy possible? If so, how can I remedy it? Answer: it certainly is possible, and there have been some high-profile cases lately, including a Baltimore newspaper reporter. Most often the chemical is from pine rosin, used in the printing process. An allergist can confirm this with skin testing. Avoiding the newspaper ink is the best solution, which may include simply washing your hands after reading the newspaper or even using gloves. Worst case, many newspapers have electronic versions that can be read via handheld devices or your computer. Crohn's concerns. Dear Dr. Roach, I have Crohn's disease. Have had Crohn's disease for the past 30 years, since I was a teenager. I've taken a large dose of Lamotril. I also have taken loperamide for many years. Lamotril is apparently controversial, but has never caused any side effects for me. The gastroenterologists I've seen over the years have been very reluctant to prescribe Lamotril. Why? Lamotil, a combination of diphenoxylate and atropine, is an antidiarrheal agent. It slows down the gut, which can improve symptoms as well as improve absorption of fluids and nutrients. However, it does not treat the underlying causes of diarrhea, and long-term use of any antidiarrheal agent may prompt the doctor to reevaluate why you were having diarrhea and whether you are getting the right treatment. In the case of Crohn's disease, it is not uncommon to need antidiarrheal medication long-term. Many experts prefer loperamide due to its safety record, but if you haven't had problems in 30 years with Lamotil, it's unlikely you will. Some habits, okay. Dear Dr. Roach, my son is 40 years old. After a recent stress test, he ended up with 5 stents in his arteries and also was diagnosed with diabetes. His doctors ordered him not to go back to work for 3 or 4 weeks, but he went back after 3 days. He told the doctor that he would be more stressed if he stayed home. His job is mostly sitting down. Since he didn't follow advice, how will this affect his health? Signed, VB. Answer, we don't normally have people stay home for long periods of time after placement of stents, so I was surprised to hear that he was ordered. I almost never order, only recommend, more or less strongly, to stay home. My experience is that after receiving life-changing diagnoses, such as diabetes or coronary artery disease, it is best to keep some habits, such as work, the same and change others. For your son, I am sure he will be recommended a proper diet for diabetes and exercise appropriate for a person with new diagnosis of heart disease. Nicotine, a cure for colitis? Dear Dr. Roach, I just read your column about ulcerative colitis. Many years ago, I read about a possible relief, nicotine. I have a friend who was in dire straits for years, and he was ready to get a colostomy. He has not responded to all kinds of steroids and expensive meds. He was treated with nicotine patches, and in 48 hours, he had relief. He wore a patch for at least a year. He moved a year ago, but when I met him, he looked at nicotine for a cure. Any thoughts? Signed, R. I learned in medical school that ulcerative colitis could appear or flare up after quitting smoking, and that studies were being done to look at nicotine as a treatment. Since then, nicotine has been more extensively studied, but has not found a major role in the treatment of UC. It is used occasionally, and even more occasionally successful, in people who have not gotten relief with more common treatments. The side effects of high doses may cause people to not tolerate it. The booklet on diverticulitis explains this common inflammatory bowel disorder and its treatments. Readers can order a copy by writing Dr. Roach. Dear Abby, Aunt weighs responsibility for her late-in-life nephew. Dear Abby, my sister Adele chose to adopt a baby boy when she was in her late 50s. She isn't married. Before the adoption, she asked me if something happened to her, would I take care of the child? I had already raised my children and was going through a divorce, so I said, no, I'm too old and I want to enjoy my future retirement. She got mad. Adele is now approaching 70 with a high-maintenance 12-year-old son who has signed up for every extracurricular activity under the sun. I have seen him twice since the adoption. If and when the question comes up again, how do I handle it? Signed, Aunt in Pennsylvania. Dear Aunt, after you refused to request, your sister probably asked someone else, someone more involved in her and her son's daily lives, to step in. However, if she didn't, then in the event of her death or serious illness, that renders her unable to parent her son, you may have to decide what you are prepared to do. Cross your fingers and hope she remains healthy until her boy reaches adulthood. Then consider this. Your nephew is no longer a little boy. In 6 years, he will be 18. It's not as if you would be changing diapers and arranging for daycare. It shouldn't ruin your retirement to take him in if no one else does. Remember the golden rule. Rejected. Dear Abby, I'm a 25-year-old who's been dating a great guy for a year. The relationship is everything I have dreamed of and more. My only concern is that my friends don't seem to care much for him. That doesn't bother me, but what does bother me is that they are distancing themselves from me now. I am no longer invited to gatherings. My best friend doesn't keep in touch anymore, and I've given up on trying to reach out every time. If I do manage to talk to her, she makes an excuse to get off the phone as quickly as possible. I have never done this to any of my friends, regardless of whom they were dating or what life threw at them. Is this a normal part of life? Should I reconsider my friendships? Signed, Bothered in Boston. Dear Bothered, relationships sometimes ebb and flow. before reconsidering these friendships, have a frank and honest chat with these women about why they don't like your boyfriend. That your BFF would treat you the way she has is puzzling. Unless she's jealous because you spend so much time with your boyfriend, or he has offended her in some way. On a different note, does this man have friends of his own? Do the two of you socialize with other couples? Having been together for a year, are you making new friends together? If the answer to these questions is yes, then it may indeed be time to move on from this tribe of girlfriends. And one more editorial column from Leonard Pitts, Tribune News Service. The City of Light will shine again. I believe the light that shines on you will shine on you forever, though I can't guarantee there's nothing scary hiding under your bed. From Father and Daughter by Paul Simon. My wife has a bad knee and isn't much for long walks, so that night, after the Channel train had brought us over from London and we set out on foot from the hotel to do some exploring, I wasn't expecting to go far, maybe a block, maybe two. I have no idea how far we actually went, but I know it's a lot farther than a couple of blocks. I kept asking if she was okay. Marilyn kept assuring me that she was and wanted to keep going. She was enraptured, as I was. Walking through Paris was like walking through magic. We went down a fairy tale street, paused on a bridge overlooking the Seine to watch the glass-topped dinner cruises plying the water, ended up at the Place de la Concorde, looking west along the Champs-Élysées. In the distance, the Arc de Triomphe glowed. Some cities disappoint you, some cities you visit, and that thing that they're known for, that thing that people come from around the world to experience, turns out to be an exaggeration, myth or mirage. In the 70s, I used to feel sorry for tourists who came to Hollywood, which has since been largely redeveloped, only to find that the fabled film capital was little more than office buildings, souvenir shops, and street corners where prostitutes gathered six deep. But Paris is exactly what they say. Paris is, in reputation and in fact, the City of Light. So I suppose we ought not to be surprised that it now finds itself under attack from the forces of shadow. By now you've already heard all you can stand, and then some, about the series of coordinated terrorist assaults by ISIS that left well over 100 people dead on Friday. By now you have already wept or prayed or vented your fury, or wondered aloud what this world is coming to, or simply stood mute in the face of humankind's seemingly bottomless capacity for savagery. And it's no accident it was Paris. Like New York City 14 years ago, it was a representational target. New York stands for American power, and September 11th was meant to spit in the eye of that power. Paris stands for light, and the events of November 13th sought to eclipse the glow. Paris has always been a beacon of such things. That may have been part of the reason Adolf Hitler ordered the city destroyed when his troops were driven out in 1944. It may have been part of the reason General Dietrich von Choltitz disobeyed the order. The quote at the top of this column is from a song not about terror, but about a father's love for the bright light that is his daughter and his promise to be there for her in a world of uncertainty and threat. No, it's not monsters hiding under the bed by which civilization is menaced, but it's monsters just the same, forces of savagery, ignorance, hatred, fundamentalism, and extremism striking from corners where light does not reach, and no one can guarantee perpetual safety against such threats. But we can strike back hard when they come, as France is doing now. In the long run, though, it isn't bullets and bombs these monsters fear the most, hate the most, or that hurts them the most. No, that which lurks in shadow despises light, and well it should. Light reveals bankrupt ideologies for the failures they are. Light draws people together. Light gives courage, and light gives hope. So, vive la France, and shine on. This is Barbara Ridenour, and that's all we have time for November 20th, 2015. Have a great weekend and a great Thanksgiving. Let's think about all we're thankful for. I look forward to reading with you again soon.